Hey there, you're very welcome to episode 3 of season 2 of Triton Lake Perform. My name is Connor Smith, founder and CEO of Triton Lake, a global marketplace connecting sophisticated investors with alternative opportunities. In 2021, Triton Lake became the title sponsor of the Ireland men's and women's rugby sevens teams. This podcast explores the intersections of sport and business, looking at what both worlds can learn from each other and assesses the key parts to the puzzle of high performance. Today, we're delighted to be joined by Sue Anstis, MBE. Sue is an activist who has made incredible strides for women in sport. With over 30 years experience in public relationships and sports marketing, Sue is also an accomplished author, filmmaker and podcast host. A founding trustee of the Women's Sports Trust, Sue is now CEO of Fearless Women, an organisation which drives change across women's sport. Sue, you're very welcome. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much. Yeah, fantastic to be here.
Good. Maybe to kick us off, you might take us back a little bit and tell us where your passion and drive came from to help women in sport.
Yeah, I guess my passion for sport began in my very early days. I was quite sporty as a child, quite a sporty family. I had three brothers who were all very sporty. So I think that's kind of where my initial love of sport began. But probably the women's sport side came a bit later. I guess I was a woman in sport. Probably the last 15, 20 years, it has the real passion for women's sport and driving change through women's sport really come to life.
Oh, very good. And I mean, did your time in Loughborough University shape some of that career as well?
Absolutely. My brothers used to joke that I went to Loughborough to read books and games. That was my kind of degree subject. So English and PE in sports science. So yeah, I did shape it there. Although I look back now, I kind of feel I didn't really perhaps see the inherent sexism that existed within sport at the time. And I know some of my colleagues, especially some of the women working with me at the Women's Sport Trust, saw that from a really young age. And I think at the time, probably like many of my generation, we just grew up.
That's
what we accepted. Yeah. I was quite sporty. Yeah. And that's as it was. So I don't think I saw it as much as I do now, looking back now. Yeah.
And when you do look back, I guess, what do you see as the obvious points of inequality that really stood out?
I think that probably in the biggest way is not being able to play. So I never had the chance. I probably could have just started at Loughborough. I was at Loughborough 85. So rugby was just starting, and obviously women had played for decades and decades before, but just starting more professionally, as it were, being played in a professional manner around that time. But in terms of football and cricket and all those sports, I wouldn't really have had any opportunity to play those growing up in the 70s. So I think those were probably the biggest pieces. And then never seeing women's coverage, you know, again, you look back and realise actually we just accepted that there wasn't women's sport on the television, on radio, on newspapers. So I think it's almost looking back and realising. And I love the Olympic Games. I think for a long time, because I'd seen more equality there, I hadn't really noticed there was a disparity in those sports that I loved, but probably more of the team sports.
Team sports and tennis, I guess, as well. You see, it was a lot more, right?
Yeah.
But even sports like golf, less so back then.
My mum was a massive... My dad that was a really massive sports fan, but my mum loved Wimbledon. That was kind of her 2 weeks in the year where we had to leave her alone to sit, you know, give her time to watch tennis. And she loved Virginia Wade and Yvonne Goolagong. So all of that time, those, you know, Martina, those are the women that I remember loving through her loving them too. So yeah, so tennis, so probably the sports that I saw and watched as a family, I felt were more equal without seeing all that was going on behind them.
No, sure. And if we fast forward a little bit now, maybe as CEO of Fearless Women, obviously you've made incredible strides for women in sport, but maybe tell us some of the highlights of the work to date.
Yeah, and the Fearless Women came about just a couple of years ago, sort of coming out of COVID really as a consultancy to house all the work that I was then doing around women's sport. So the Game Changers podcast, the book that I'd written, the speaking that I do. And then the main piece really was created the Women's Sport Collective. So a network, but it started very informally. Just we got together 50, 60 women that we work with in sport during COVID online to chat and try and, you know, catch up and build a bit more of a connections. And from that grew this fantastic network for women across sport. So those are the things I guess I'm most proud of, really, is the growth of that. I think we've got nearly 5,500 members now in the Women's Sport Collective. But the way that's grown and the impact it's having, we know it's having because women keep telling us, but in terms of those connections and that confidence to take on new roles and progress, you know, gender parity in the industry is what we're after, and it's fantastic to feel we're having some impact there.
And with the Women's Sport Collective, then, if we touch on that for a sec, what changes have you seen in the last few years and been a part of that have furthered the ambition of the collective?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is around those conversations of getting women in the right places and, you know, more representation on those senior roles and senior boards and, you know, in the management of sport. That's really our ambition. And to highlight those jobs, I think I do talk a lot. I talk in schools and universities, and often women particularly aren't really aware of all the jobs that exist in sport. So I think that's part of the role that we're doing, is to showcase both within the collective itself and outside of that, the jobs that do exist in sport and those amazing females, you know, showcasing the women that are doing brilliant jobs, as not just within the management of sport, but as coaches and referees and officials and all those fantastic places where men have always been and women absolutely can be too. Sometimes it's just seeing women having success in those roles that encourages others to think they could do that as well.
And it probably touches on the partnership with Sky Sports as well, right? And the role of the broadcasters on that journey.
Yeah, indeed. And Sky have been a fantastic partner for us. They've backed us from the very early days. We had 2 years of support. We're a not-for-profit and we are at the moment completely funded by Sky. They can enable us to do what we do. So, it's been interesting. Great that they have supported us to grow the collective, but also mirroring what they're doing both internally, you know, behind camera as well as in front of camera, and the growth we've seen in women as broadcasters and pundits, and the coverage of women's sport. And it, you know, the Women's Sport Collective isn't just about women's sport; it's about women working across all sport, men's and women's. But amazing to see what Sky have done, not just recently, over 30 years, but what they're doing at the moment in terms of what's coming up this year with women's sport. And I think, you know, you're obviously aware of that too. But it's fantastic to see that real shift in terms of the coverage that they're giving it and the quality of coverage too.
Yeah, absolutely. In terms of some of the stories, I guess, across the podcast, your work as an author, Changing the Game newsletter, you're firsthand telling really important stories about women in sport. Are there maybe a story or two that you've come across that really inspires some of the work you're doing, or a couple of examples you'd like to share?
Yeah, there are many stories, really. I think sometimes it's amazing that I do get to talk to these incredible trailblazing women. And it's, I obviously get a bit in awe of talking to amazing athletes that I've admired from afar. But often it is the women that I didn't know of before I spoke to them that are really making a difference and driving change, often behind the scenes. And one of my favourites from the Game Changers is Rose Riley, who's a Scottish footballer who was banned from playing in Scotland and played in Italy and won the World Cup with Italy, actually, in the end. But like an amazing, just really passionate. And you kind of hear, I guess, how much it meant to them at that time to not be able to play. You know, unlike me, who just didn't play and accepted that I couldn't play, women like Rose that then fought so hard for the right to play. So the stories like that, you know, that mean so much. And I think it's really important that girls today that can have access hear stories like that to know what women went through, almost, to fight so hard in order to have the opportunity that now exists for girls at all ages.
Oh, absolutely. And we touched briefly on the importance of media coverage, but I did want to touch on some more role models. I mean, we've had that example there, but how important are, I guess, not so much the historical role models, but the current role models that are there to the next generation of young girls that are, you know, looking to involve themselves in sport?
Yeah, it's so important, isn't it? And I think even looking back in the last 10 years or so, but just the number of women. I mean, I've been very lucky on the Game Changers to talk to Claire Balding and Gabby Logan and, you know, many others, Ellie Aldroyd and others, the journalists. There's so many that cover so many sports, that not just specialists in one sport, but as broadcasters. But also those female athletes that are now coming through as pundits and having that opportunity as an exit past their career, which again men have had for, you know, decades and decades, but amazing that women are having that opportunity too, and that we're seeing women covering men's sport, and we're you know, beginning to normalize just seeing women on our screens. And I think you'll always, you know, the wonderful world of social media, we'll always see a negativity and pushback for women's shrill voices talking about things they shouldn't know about. Men get very protective of for some men, I should say, get very protective, especially in the space of football. But the more that we see them and the more that it becomes the norm and they are excellent, and they have, many of them had to work much harder than the men to be accepted in that space. But I love it. I love that you watch, you know, you're watching it now. It just feels like it's just normal. It's not like a, wow, look, there was that woman on screen. Actually, now it's just become a norm, and that's kind of fantastic. And not just, you know, it's great for sport and it's great to see that. But for me, the bigger piece is what that means to women and girls at home seeing women represented as part of something that's so important culturally to us all. And so women as broadcasters and on screen is very important, as is women playing, and us seeing women playing and competing too. But for me, it's the biggest societal piece of when we don't see women there, what that says to women versus when it's just normal. You know, goodness me, who knew women can talk articulately and brilliantly on sport just like men?
A crucial pillar of the Women's Sport Trust is improving the funding landscape, which is obviously important to all of this. What are the challenges that are there, and what role can sponsors or other sources of funding play to increase the visibility of some of those role models we talked about, and in general to help the funding landscape?
Yeah, and I would just say, so the Women's Sport Trust is a charity that was founded in 2012 by Tammy Parlour and Joe Bostock. So just post 2012, the Olympic Games, and has worked really hard across that decade. We've celebrated our 10 years at the end of last year in terms, as you say, of raising that visibility, increasing the visibility for athletes and sports, and that pipeline of funding coming into sport, and sport not just women's sport not just being seen as worthy and something that was deserving of the CSR pound, but actually commercially viable. So yeah, there's lots that others can do, and I think sometimes just showcasing and sharing news of the success that is there. I think there seems to be many brands that are almost waiting to see someone go first and have success before they follow financially, and I do feel we're beginning to see that tipping point. And I think even in the last 2 or 3 years, it's not even 10 years, but I think the likes of Barclays and Vitality and Google, and, you know, you've in terms of Lidl and, you know, brands in Ireland too, coming in and really backing women's sport, I do think that opens the door to others think, oh, you know, oh, there's something going on there almost. There's an opportunity, there's a commercial opportunity, and others will follow. So we're definitely seeing more of that. And to celebrate and recognise the value of these amazing role models, the female role models that perhaps haven't had that profile in the past. The Women's Sport Trust runs an unlocked program where they pair elite female athletes with activators, so people in business, sport, media, etc., to kind of really help them to amplify what their passion is around their social purpose. And that's been hugely, hugely successful. But again, giving those role models profile and enabling them to have some influence, it's been really, really powerful. And with that, then brings kind of sponsors and investors because they see the power of that.
The power of it. And just out of curiosity on that one, where do you forge the relationships with those activators, and who does the matching of the activator and the sports person and so forth?
Yeah, that's the Women's Sport Trust. That's us as a board, yeah. And a group, and some other advisors too will pair them. And you know, and generally they've always been massively successful because you've got these extraordinary athletes from a vast range of sports and backgrounds paired with contacts and connections. And a lot of it is about the black books, is about not just the people they're paired with, but who those people are connected to as well too. So we've had some amazing kind of success stories of athletes who have then got on boards, or they have then found new roles in covering, you know, Olympics, Paralympics, and just new to be able to kind of hone the ideas, the passions that they have. It may be a passion to drive more girls in terms of participation, or it may be around racial inclusion. It might be around disability. It might be some of them are in terms of, you know, sustainability. So a whole kind of different areas that women might be passionate. You know, some just want to be amazing athletes, but the majority we find have other passions that they want to do more with. Some is around commercial viability and raising profile too. So yeah, it's been hugely successful.
Good. A bit closer to home here in Ireland, we're on the crest of a wave in women's sport, and with, you know, incredible success in boxing, horse racing, the emergence of incredible talents in the Irish rugby sevens and 15s teams. And now we have the FIFA Women's World Cup to look forward to this summer. How do we ensure that Ireland can capitalise on these successes and, you know, follow through on it?
Yeah, it's been fantastic. It is fantastic. Sometimes I feel like I'm watching and I keep apprised of news that's happening. And it is so exciting. It does feel like it's one thing after the other in terms of the growth and progression. I think there's lots that I think it was today actually, is the IRFU have just announced an ambition for a 40% gender parity on the council. So I look across and think, oh, I wish that, you know, actually that ability to maybe be a little bit more mobile, be quick in action. Are there some of our councils and boards that could follow suit. But sometimes I think perhaps without having so much tied to them, they're able to be a little bit more mobile and make decisions and so on. So that's really exciting. And I think, as you say, just to see the success that's come, that isn't just, you know, on a UK, GB wide stage, but globally, the Katie Taylors of this world, it is quite extraordinary. So I think it is about celebrating, and it is about each of them feeding off each other. I'm sure that is, you know, it's the same in, because I sit across quite a lot of English sport, but the teams that support each other, athletes supporting each other, and I'm sure that must be the same across all the home nations of, you know, supporting the other female athletes that are also having huge success.
Annie, I feel like it's funny to hear you saying that and looking over and thinking that sometimes we can be a bit more nimble. It feels like there's still plenty to be done here, right? And it feels like it's relatively new still, versus, you know, the progress that's been made. And what are the things that you found worked well in the UK? I mean, you've touched on a couple of them there. So it's, you know, cross-gender support of the relevant teams, obviously getting some of that corporate buy-in behind it as well. But is there anything else you could have pointed to that, you know, maybe we could learn here in Ireland that's worked well in the UK?
I think collaboration as well too. I think sometimes that's a little bit overlooked, but the learning from others and they'd be willing to share. I think that's something we've definitely seen within the Women's Sport Collective, and probably more within women's sport perhaps than men's historically. But that willingness to learn and share and support and encourage others to develop too. So I definitely think, I spoke to Rachel Pavlow on the podcast quite recently from the FA, and she talked about when, you know, the England team weren't doing so well, they spoke to other nations that were doing really well, so Sweden and others that were doing really well in terms of women's football. And they always said when England did well, they in turn would support and help others in the development of their grassroots programs and pathways, and they're doing that now. So I do think that, you know, asking questions, looking to learn from others, knowing that, you know, we don't need to reinvent the wheel, we can collaborate and learn from others too. So I do think that is really key. But as you said, the male allies, you know, is such an important part, is to get the buy-in of. And you know, sadly, in a capitalist world, it's money that it comes down to. And I think the beginning to see the success, the financial success of women's sport, is perhaps what's driving that big shift now.
No, absolutely. And I think beyond that and beyond the players themselves, we've also seen a big increase in the women involved in the coaching side and the high performance side. And here in Irish rugby here, we've seen the appointments of Gillian McDarby to the head of women's performance and pathways. Niamh Briggs is the assistant coach of the Irish rugby women's team. How important is that female leadership piece in terms of women's sport? Because I know we've had a few podcasts and conversations, and clearly there's a whole pathway conversation on how women should engage in high performance training at an early age. And there's all kinds of question marks over injury profiles and everything else. But it feels to me like the more of those female leaders that are there in women's sport, it's going to play a really key part in the development and opportunity for the players.
It really does, doesn't it? And sometimes I feel it's so obvious to say that, and you don't want, we need more women to make it better for the women that are coming through. But it does feel like it's a really obvious example. I was at a fantastic event last Friday with the RFU. It's part of the Impact for the World Cup in 2025, the first Impact event. About 235 female coaches and referees in rugby coming together and learning from each other, and lots of conversation around that, around actually for women and girls coming into the sport, having female coaches and female officials does make such a difference, because especially if they're coming new to, again, they've not played, they may have just found it at university or, you know, slightly older ages than some of the young boys that are coming through. The coaches treat them really differently. They understand them. Yeah. They understand their bodies, their needs. You know, we're not just small versions of men. And I think sometimes it almost feels a bit uncomfortable to be saying that, but it is the truth. And actually having more women in those positions, in decision-making positions, will make a massive difference in its beginning. So it's really exciting last week to see. So it was really quite emotional, really, to see so many amazing young women who have recently qualified, you know, along with others who have been around in the game for a long, long time. But just seeing the difference that's going to make as they filter out into that game, and then encourage, you know, what that will mean to a young girl turning up to know there's a female coach, female official, female manager, you know, it is going to make a big difference. And actually for many women from some cultures, you know, that will only really want to come along if there are women leading and managing. So that's really important and powerful too.
And the cultural thing is clearly a big issue, right? And some countries are really going to struggle more with that. We see a little bit of an example on it on the women's rugby stage. I shouldn't mention specific countries, but I just know from speaking to people that it's a real challenge in some regions. And it almost feels like the cultural piece needs to catch up on itself first before you can properly have a chance, right? Is there anything that can be done in those situations to accelerate? I know you touched on nations talking to each other and those kind of things. That clearly will help. But you got to get the country to see people on an equal footing before the sport is ever going to get there, you know?
Yeah, and I think if we wait for that, you know, we may be waiting forever, might we? So I do think there's a lot that sport can do. And I think the inclusivity of sport, and I use rugby as a specific example here, but whether it is women being able to wear the hijab and play in the hijab, playing to be fully covered as they're playing, you know, to be inclusive, to have more female coaches and opportunities. And I look at the work that World Rugby, and when Katie Sadlier was in place before Sally Horrocks, but the work that they've done in terms of building and creating those communities, developing female leaders in those areas who then go on to lead others. So I do think, and I'm closer to rugby probably than I'm sure football and cricket and other sports are doing amazing, in netball too, doing amazing jobs. But I think that you can make that difference. And actually, clothing is such a key part. It's something I feel very strongly about. But, you know, considering the clothing, both how much, you know, not forcing women into clothing or out of clothing, but enabling women to have choice in what they play in is a really key component. You look at the hijab bans and how that impacted women playing football and then into basketball and other sports too. Actually, that can have a massive cultural impact in terms of stopping women from playing sports. So I do think, yeah, we can't wait for those societies to sort themselves out. But sport can be so powerful, and you know, a powerful both a release and escape for women and girls, but also, you know, clearly we know it can have such cultural impacts too.
And I think if you look into the crystal ball maybe for a minute, and we try and look, you've probably been asked this 100 times, but if you'd look forward, what does the future look like? I mean, even just from the rugby perspective, what changes do you see in the next 5 years, 10 years? Or is it just a kind of continued evolution of what's been progressing well?
Yeah, I don't think it is just a continued evolution, because I feel it's interesting, isn't it? Over the last, I talk a lot about from 2012 to 2022, and I wrote my book. I wrote my book like 2021. So the book was almost like that. Oh, we've seen this magnificent growth. And actually since then, since the book's published, the growth's been exponential in terms of the visibility and the funding and the crowds coming in and everything. So I think the growth isn't just a linear growth that we've seen. It has really spiked. It won't keep spiking at that rate forever, but it does really feel like we've had that shift. I don't particularly like the phrase tipping point, because I think you would have said there's been that in many opportunities in women's sport in the past, be it Title IX in the US or Billie Jean King. Shifts have happened, but it does really feel like here and now that there's enough. For me, it's the different components that are falling in place. So it's not just about funding or visibility or gender equality on boards or accessing grassroots. It's all those things coming together at the same time, and sponsorship and so on. So I do think, especially for a sport like rugby, you look at the percentage of growth that's coming from the women's game, the quality of, you know, no one could watch that World Cup at Eden Park and not think, you know, the future's female. Most amazing sport with sponsorship and backing and fabulous coverage too. Yes, I'm really, really excited. And I do feel finally, not the rest of the world's caught up, but the commercial world in terms of those sponsors and broadcasters are seeing that there is this huge opportunity there. So I'm really excited, and I think it will just grow. I'm kind of more excited for the future than I've ever been before. I do think change is definitely happening, and happening fast.
No, great. One of the things we've done in these podcasts is kind of getting a wrap-up question and around one piece of advice. So maybe you can help us and give us a piece of advice that you'd give to someone that's looking to establish themselves as a leader in this place.
Yeah, and it might not surprise you, as I'm working, you know, within the Women's Sport Collective, but networking, I think for me, networking has been absolutely key. If I look back at the way my company's grown in the past, but the way that I've thrived and flourished and enjoyed, you know, working in this sector has been about building that network and connections. So, you know, networking as in thinking about what you can do for other people rather than looking at what they can do for you too. But that's the advice I tend to give to people is, yeah, put your hand up and say yes to, in those early stages of taking on new opportunities, being brave, but also just to build those connections. I think that's really key.
And they're two-way connections, as you say, right? Because they'll always benefit each other. Yeah,
absolutely.
Sue, thank you for joining us today. It's been really interesting and insightful to hear about the impact your work has made on women's sport and your thoughts on its direction here in Ireland and across the world. We're looking forward to seeing you continue to create change in the industry in the years ahead, and hopefully the Irish Rugby Women's Sevens team can play a role along the way as well. That's all for episode 3 of season 2 of Triton Lake Perform. Thanks for listening and we hope you enjoyed it. Stay tuned as we look forward to chatting to a great lineup of guests across the rest of this season.